A Nokia feature phone steals hearts at the Mobile World Congress. Soon our shoes will be smarter than we are, and rich people go to the moon. Finally, what would you do if a drone crashed through your apartment window? All that and a whole lot more coming up on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for Twit's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make Twit even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1713, recorded Monday, February 27th, 2017. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/TNT. And by Epson's new EcoTank printers. With Epson's line of SuperTank all-in-one printers, you can print thousands of documents without running out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to find out more. Hello and welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about some of the biggest tech news stories of the day with people who are about passionate about technology. I am Megan Maroney. Jason Howell is out today. But joining me via Skype is Scott Johnson from the Frog Pants Network. Welcome back to the show, Scott.
I just figured something out. Every time Jason's gone, who originally was born and raised in Idaho, I'm here in Salt Lake City, Utah. So anytime the tall, lanky Rocky Mountain guy isn't here, you get another tall, lanky Rocky Mountain guy in his place.
Yeah, that's important. Except, you know, I don't always have you in place. On Martin Luther King Day, I had ONJJ Stone in Jason's place, and he got pretty upset because he was like, I'm working on Martin Luther King Day, and Jason is not. So I don't know. I guess I gave you Martin Luther King Day off too today. I don't know why. I mean, last month.
Thank you for that. I enjoyed that day. I used it to its fullest potential, but I'm really happy to be here. Always happy to come on and hang out with you and talk tech.
I am happy to have you. And for people that might have just started watching our show, why don't you tell them a little bit about what you do at the Frog Pants Network?
Sure. So I've got this little thing I run called Frog Pants at frogpants.com, and it's a collection of podcasts and art and other things, social activities and stuff that people may be familiar with in this audience. If you're not, you can go check it out at frogpants.com. In fact, I just updated the website, so a little easier to navigate and get around and find the stuff you want. And all the shows are accessible there. You can find out when they are, live stuff, all that, over at frogpants.com. And I think, you know, something in there for everybody, so go check it out.
Mm-hmm. I do like that picture of the Hotline Monday picture. You and Justin Robert Young, that says so much.
We just recorded that, and it's funny. Every episode basically is that photo in audio form. Like, it literally, what you see there is essentially what you're going to listen to. So,
and you get to speak, though, because your mouth is shut in that picture. But you
yeah, that's right. Well, I got to let him talk. And, you know, that guy, well, he can talk.
Well, let's get to some talking of our own. Mobile World Congress started this week in Barcelona, this weekend. As expected, there were no flagship phones from Samsung. Instead, the news was filled with stories of the new BlackBerry with a physical keyboard and the Nokia 3310 that lets you play Snake. We also saw a tall and skinny LG G6 with an 18:9 screen aspect ratio that's designed to make it easier to see two documents side by side. So far, do you have a favorite Mobile World Congress announcement yet, Scott?
Well, this Nokia phone is like this weird retro throwback to a phone I had in the 90s. And I feel like I wasn't ready for that yet. I feel like I don't need to be told yet that Nokia phones, candy bar or otherwise, flip or otherwise, are now considered classic hardware. Outside of that, though, none of this is too shocking. I am a little disappointed we didn't get anything new from Samsung. I feel like this is going to be a big year for them to not distance themselves, but get to a place away from the controversy that was the Note 7 and get their footing back in a way that is more conducive to better PR, to their customer base, to those who may have been on the edge about where they were going to get their next smartphone, and really plant their flag and remind us why they're one of the better hardware makers. So a little, maybe nothing in this conference so far has jumped out at me, but the one thing that has jumped out is not a lot from Samsung, which means we got to wait a little longer until we hear what they're up to.
Yeah, I think I heard it was sometime in March they're going to make the announcement, maybe late March, maybe April. But yeah, so what about the BlackBerry? Were you ever a BlackBerry fan?
I was for a hot minute back in the day, way back in the day, when they were the dominant platform in the emerging market of smartphones. And when you bring them up today, I'm always surprised that it's either not a story about them being bought or sold or laying off a bunch of people or some negative story. So when I hear that they're making something new or they have something new on the horizon, I'm both excited and a little perplexed because I still don't quite understand what their market is. Clearly somebody somewhere, they're buying these phones from BlackBerry. Obviously not the numbers that they used to, and maybe not the numbers that they would want, but they still exist in a way that surprises me. So I guess I don't want to wish them any kind of doom, but I'm always a little surprised that they have something new.
Yeah, I guess this isn't really, it runs Android, doesn't run the BlackBerry OS, and it's not even really BlackBerry. I think it's the name. It's just a Chinese company, Chinese electronics conglomerate, TCL, which I keep wanting to say TLC, but it's not TLC, it's TCL. So yeah, it's BlackBerry, I feel, and name only. And I just don't want a physical keyboard anymore. I'm done with that.
Yeah, somebody said, I remember that. If let's all go back to 2008, if we can, 2007 or so. And everybody everywhere was saying, well, I don't know if I hold to these new keyboards that are fake and on a screen. That seems like the wrong direction. And I remember so much naysaying going on. Microsoft themselves came out and said, no way, nobody's going to do a virtual keyboard and they're not going to pay that kind of money. And there was so much controversy about a non-physical keyboard. And now it's just the flip of it. Nobody wants that, needs that. They look at a phone like that and say, well, where'd all my screen real estate go? I don't want a physical keyboard. I want one that can go away when I'm not using it. And I think we have just made a collective human switch from, oh, no, don't take away my tactile physical keyboard, to why did we care so much at the time? Mm-hmm. I still don't know why we cared so much.
I don't know why we cared so much at the time either. Let's move on. Now, game streaming service at Twitch will let viewers buy games straight from the stream. Streamers will get 5% off the profits of the sale of the game. This is starting in the spring of 2017. Now, Amazon, of course, owns Twitch, and Twitch is also part of Amazon Prime, which I'm not really sure how this works. I know you have a Twitch channel, and so what does this mean? Does this mean anything for you?
It does. It also, well, okay, so two things it does. It tells me that Amazon will continue to slowly but surely flesh out what Twitch is beyond what it started as. And that has meant some pretty interesting moves on their part lately. One of the biggest was taking the channel from pure gaming only and bringing a little of the old Justin TV that spawned it back into it and saying, hey, people can come on here and stream whatever they want as long as it's, you know, within the scope of the rules. And that opened up a floodgate for a lot of people, including me. I was able to get partnered right away. I was able to have, in some cases, double and triple my audience numbers for smaller streams that I was running otherwise. And it can be everything from gaming to non-gaming content, like my morning show or like my Hotline Monday show we talked about earlier, Current Geek and whatnot. So the combination has been really, really good for me, and I think a real boon to the service. That was a huge move, and it made me think, ooh, they've got some plans up their sleeves. So their Twitch Prime subscription, which is free for everybody to apply to a streamer of their choice every month, is a really great way to not only get money in the hands of streamers, but to further extend the value of the Prime subscription you're already paying to Amazon. And now this, it's just yet another way for especially popular channels to generate some revenue. And this is in line with what I think Twitch's goals and Amazon's goals for Twitch are, which is Amazon and Twitch need to keep finding ways to make money through the service directly. And they've done it through a lot of weird creative ways, through social stuff with bits and cheering and emotes and all the other traditional ways that you can get money via the service, including subscriptions, which are built right in if you're a partner channel. this is just a new way to do that, and they're going to get a chunk of it. It's also really good for game developers, especially small indie developers. A lot of them count on word of mouth from popular streamers who get on the service and they talk about their weird small game, and that gets the word out to their fan base, and they have way more exposure than they would have had in any other way, especially in such a crowded marketplace right now. So I think this is a really good thing. It's sort of a triple win. Everybody's going to get money from this in a very fair and equitable way. And it's another reason for people to stay on the service, never quite leave the service. So it makes perfect strategic sense and makes me wonder what they've still got to show us in the next year or two.
So do you play a lot of indie, like weird games that many people haven't heard of?
I do. I use a service that was co-founded by a friend of mine called keymailer.co. And basically, it's a service that helps facilitate a relationship between indie developers, or any developers really, not just indies, but indies really benefit from it. And someone like me who streams a lot of games, basically, it's a way to get Steam codes or PSN codes or wherever the platform might be to try out these games, sometimes in early access form, sometimes after release. But it's a great service where you can go and say, oh, that game looks like something I would like, or that my audience would really get a kick out of. Let me request a key. You request a key, they assign it to your Twitch account. So there's, you can't really cheat the system and give them away or have them end up in the wrong hands. And suddenly there's the game. I get to play it. People get to see it. They have another level of exposure in an audience they may not have had access to through traditional advertising methods. And it's worked out really well. So those services combined with this move on their part is pretty interesting, because in theory, I could get a key from Keymailer, which would be a lot like me getting a key directly from some developer, play their video game, drive 50 to 100 people to buy it, and now they could do that directly through the channel, and everybody through that line of promotion would see a piece of that. That's a really interesting way to monetize things. So I'm kind of impressed, actually, that they're doing this. I really just thought, I honestly believe that Amazon would buy this and then just let Twitch do what Twitch does, and it would just be this value-add thing over there, and it would just kind of function on its own. And they wouldn't really touch it all that much. And I think I was wrong. I think they have grand plans for it. And like I say, I'm really stoked about what's next for it. And it's good for, the main thing is it's really good for creators and people who are out there, you know, spending their time building content, building audiences. And this goes a long way, I think, to support that.
And I mean, YouTube has something. So I mean, YouTube does pay some creators, but it's not as a direct line as what Twitch is talking about doing now.
Yeah, that's the main difference here is, and they've got tip systems and some other things. And I'll bet you YouTube's not, they're certainly not done telling us what they want to do with YouTube gaming and that streaming service. But they've been a little slow with it in terms of, you know, really fleshing it out or staying ahead of the curve. Whereas Twitch seems very hungry for this, especially since the Amazon purchase. They seem to really want to lock people in and keep them on this service. Not only that, but expand what they can stream so it isn't just game related. So they're feeling very competitive, I think, and I think that's going to work really well for them. YouTube and Google could swoop in and just destroy everybody's dinner anytime they wanted, probably, if they really wanted to. But their system is based so much on ad revenue, and that's true of Twitch in some small way, but it's not their main way. But the ad revenue is so big for the YouTube side, I don't see them changing much about how their creators get paid. Outside of special deals and some of the, you know, the biggest ones with with millions and millions of subscribers. In Twitch's case, they can do both the special handling of multi, you know, millions or hundreds of thousands of viewers type channels, and they can augment this with these other methods. And creators are also free to have other methods. They can have Patreons, they can have donation links, they can have a PayPal link right there in their channel. So they're not limited to, you know, one or two kinds of revenue like they are with YouTube currently, versus what they can do on Twitch. So it's a little bit of a war brewing there. The question is, does Google have the willpower to care as much as Twitch is right now? And Twitch really seems to care. So we will see.
Well, some other news coming out of Barcelona this week is that Masayoshi Son, an executive at SoftBank, says computers will exceed human intelligence in a mere 30 years. Also, super smart robots will outnumber humans, and more than a trillion objects will be connected to the internet. Unclear if the speech was meant only to frighten us to death or to promote the fact that SoftBank's semiconductor subsidiary Arm says it will be equipped to produce the trillions of chips needed to power our internet of everything. One of the chips, was a quote also from his speech, he says, one of the chips in our shoes will be smarter than our brain, he said. We will be less than our shoes, and we will be stepping on them. So what do you think of that, Scott?
I mean, I don't know. I feel like every other day or every other hour, sometimes there's a new story about machine learning and AI and, you know, capacity and where we're going to be with cloud computing and how it's all going to change everything. And that most of it will be, you know, AI-based assistants and they're all going to take our jobs. There's one negative way of looking at it. And the other way is there'll be millions of jobs created by having to manage this sort of stuff. And honestly, after a while, it starts to sort of blend into the same big goopy mess of what the future is going to be. I usually take these kinds of things not all that seriously, but then once in a while, somebody like Elon Musk or somebody will pipe up and go, hey, guess what? We have two people flying around the moon this year in 2017, like happened this morning. And I just went, are you kidding me? So like there are moments of this isn't just we think the future is, it is we're doing it right now and we're making it happen. And the Musks of the world are very intriguing that way, obviously, but I don't know. I'm ready for our future of AIs and bots, and we're already there in a lot of cases. Like I've had a full conversation with somebody on Twitter the other day about an art question that turned out to be a bot the entire time, and I didn't know it.
Really? So, how did you finally figure it out?
Well, did I fail? Did I fail the Turing test somehow in a weird, inadvertent way? I guess I kind of did. But the way I found out was they started toward the end of the conversation sounding a little off. And I went, something's up here. So I went back and looked at their timeline, which you should always do, by the way. If you're confused by any interaction on Twitter, just read their timeline. Much will be revealed. And in this case, it was like, oh, wait, he's saying exactly these same things to a lot of people. And to my credit, they were falling for it, too. But and I don't think he was trying. It was trying to trick me. I think this bot was trying to learn something or gain information. I honestly don't know, but I had to block it because I was so annoyed with myself. So I would rather know when I'm interacting with a artificial voice or intelligence of some sort, but sometimes you don't know. And that freaked me out pretty good. But we're, like I said, we're kind of there in a lot of ways. And I talk to so many devices now, I forget how cool that is. So we're already in a lot of ways already there. The big question is what giant multinational Chinese company will run it? And that's what this is about.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that, you know, in some ways, what he said was that, you know, there are going to be robots. There is going to be AI. It really just depends on how we treat it. Like, it doesn't have to be it doesn't have to be our enemy. We can learn how to respond and react in a way that we are friends with the robots. So, I don't know. Of course, that's what the robots want us to think. But
it will always, until they're here and it's normal life. I mean, it's a slow transition, right? Let's say I went back to Megan at age 8 and I found you. You and I are about the same age. And I'd say, hey, let's go to the future and just plop right in to see what's going on. We would plop into our modern day and we would not know what to make of most of this stuff. Like we would be like, whoa, are you kidding me? There are cars driving themselves. I can talk to a thing in my kitchen and it'll turn my lights on. Like it would seem like we were transported into some science fiction film. And that's the way this works. It's this slow melt of time that we get to a new stage where it seems normal again. And we're a ways off from where a fully robotic type society will seem normal to us. And we're just not there yet. So people are going to continue to fearmonger about that and get worried about it and say, oh, that's just what the machines want you to think. Or there's real dangers with AI. And really smart people are saying these things. But as time goes on, I believe it's sort of the Occam's razor sort of approach to technology. The most sensible thing will end up winning out. And history will be a rising road with technology also. And we'll end up in a place that will just feel normal and nice. And if you could go back to 2017 and pull a kid from there into the future, he'd be just as freaked out as me and you would have been in 1989 or something. So, yeah. I mean, it's a little philosophical, but I'm not worried about it. Bring it on, I say. Let's have the future now.
So it strikes me, Scott Johnson, that not only have I never met you in person, but I've never seen you from the waist down. So how do I know that you are not artificial intelligence?
So I want you to imagine this. Here I'm sitting.
Okay.
And I'm not moving my feet or my legs, but look what I can do.
Okay.
Just Oh, I'm just kidding. It's a chair. But no, I mean, you don't know, right? I don't know either. You and I've never met. I don't know what Leo's got going on. He's got some kind of robotic host on TNT. Now, I have Jason, so I know he's real.
Okay.
But he's gone an awful lot when I'm here. I can't figure out what's going on. So, yeah.
I don't know. Okay. We'll just have to believe for now. Amit Singhal, Senior Vice President of Engineering, has left Uber due to the fact that he did not inform his current employer that his former employer had been investigating sexual harassment allegations against him. His previous employer, Google, deemed the allegation against him, quote, credible. Now, Singhal has only been at Uber for 1 month. The company claims to have done extensive background checks before hiring the former Google search SVP. So this just continues Google's very bad week into another very bad week. What I love about this story is that Kara Swisher discovered this and had to notify Uber. She's doing some excellent journalism in this. What do you think, Scott?
Well, I don't know. Like, the other thing I hear about all the time outside of AI and robots and stuff is it's kind of the underbelly of how rotten we can be to each other sometimes. And finding out, I mean, I have some sympathy for Uber. I mostly use Lyft, but I have some sympathy for them in that it rains, it pours for them right now. They're just getting hit from a lot of sides. And this is a company who's gone through years of scrutiny over various practices that they make as a corporation. And so on the one hand, I love their innovation. I love what they brought to the table. I love what that spawned. I think that they'll go down in the sort of tech history books and certainly service and internet history books as a really important point of data. But I'm frustrated that they can't seem to catch a break, and maybe those breaks aren't being caught because they are some of those poor practices. I mean, who knows with this particular case? They say they were extensive about checking into his background. I've been at companies where somebody was hired based on a certain understanding of that person turned out to be wrong. So I totally get that that stuff can slip through. So it's difficult for me to want to lay a bunch of blame on them for this specific issue, but it's hard not to notice that this is just one in a string of kind of nasty storms for them. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what it means for the long term. I don't know. It probably means a better, tighter company. It probably means better policies. It probably means a lot of things that are actually better for its health and for our health as consumers in the future. But they're going to have to weather it, I think. And this is yet another one.
Yeah, I think I said Google's very bad week, but I meant Uber's very bad week. Thanks for many people pointing that out to me. I don't know what's going to happen either. And there are tricky things about when you go from one company to another and what you're allowed to say in terms of references. It's sometimes has not made a lot of sense to me. Those laws. I know you're not allowed to say certain things. It seems like you should have been able to say this. Singhal is saying this didn't happen. That he left Google on his own. But again, I think one of the most interesting things is the journalism that Kara Swisher is doing. She had a great piece about Karen Fowler's blog entry that she wrote last week about her experience at Uber. If you are interested in it, definitely read it. For Want of a Leather Jacket, Uber is Lost. That's what it's called. And what she points out, because, you know, she's been covering Uber for since its beginning, is that Travis Kalanick really, in order to start Uber and push it forward, was really like playing up that bad guy. You know, I'm the one that's going to just push on through. And, you know, he was a jerk. He said a lot of really offensive things when he was just, you know, there was a small company and he was a genius. And now that he's a bigger company, he's sort of trying to say like, oh, I'm sorry, we're going to be better. And that's all well and good, but you can't just switch from being like the mean bad guy to the, oh, I feel your pain guy. It's going to take a while.
You see this stuff bite people a little bit in the creator space as well. Somebody will build a small but growing reputation on being a little bit caustic in a community, or someone who brings up, you know, maybe darker topics, or their YouTube videos are more targeted towards others or something. And that becomes the draw for them. And then eventually things get big enough, the scrutiny gets bigger, and before you know it, ooh, you're really under the spotlight. And some of that behavior isn't so hidden or behind the scenes anymore. And I remember once, Tom Merritt once told me, and I've always been a big believer in this. He said, you get the chat room you deserve. And I believe he's right. In the case of Uber, which is obviously a different situation, when you start that scrappy, that hungry, and that willing to sort of rebel against a system that was fighting very hard against your idea, some of that stuff doesn't hold up well later on in the culture of your company. And you see this with all kinds of companies. They're, when they're small, they're just different. They're scrappier. They're less adherent to broad rules that maybe much larger corporations stick to. And so when you get to those new stages, you're still behaving in a way that makes you only a 20-person company or something, and it can bite you in the butt. So it feels like that's what's going on to me. And that's just a company maturity thing. And again, I think they can weather it, but you know, they're going to have stuff to answer for. And it's probably not the last thing we're going to hear. I hate to say it. If I'm a betting man and I'm not really one, I'd put a few quarters in the machine that says that Uber's not done with controversy.
Probably not. Well, as you mentioned before, Elon Musk announced today that SpaceX will fly 2 space tourists around the moon in 2018. The passengers will be the only people aboard the autonomous craft. SpaceX says they'll release the names of the passengers as soon as they pass certain health and fitness tests. They will spend a week on the mission, which will take place in the SpaceX Dragon crew capsule with the Falcon Heavy rocket. The moon travelers say they are, quote, very serious about the trip. It's not at all like when a guy gives his girlfriend a puppy for Valentine's Day and then she gives it back to the shelter the next month. They are very serious about this. No one says it's a Valentine's Day gift, but I like to imagine that it was a Valentine's Day gift because that would be an awesome Valentine's Day gift. I mean,
well, with the kind of money this probably costs is probably all that you have left that you've never paid for to give for a Valentine's gift. But I'm really curious about that. I know they're not going to say the names right away, and we're probably looking for a leak, or I don't know how we're going to find out, but I think we're going to find out. In fact, speaking of Justin earlier, he predicts we're going to find out in the next 24 hours who these people are.
Oh, I thought you were going to say it was Justin, which would be awesome.
Man, he wishes he had that kind of pull and money. But I don't know who it is, but I'm excited about this. This feels also a little odd. The idea that they're going to be the only two people on that rocket, it means a lot of things. It means special training, very specialized training. It's going to mean they're going to have to run a lot of things that perhaps they're not suited to do now. I don't know, because we don't know who they are, but I'd like to think about who it might be. Is it going to be like Jeff Bezos and some other rich guy? And will Jeff's laugh drive them all nuts for the whole trip? Like I have to think about all the practical stuff. Where are the bathrooms? Can I get some privacy up here? You left milk floating in a ball in there, like whatever, like that kind of stuff is where my brain's at. So I'm really curious to find out who has the money and therefore what their temperament is, because two people cooped up in a capsule like that for an extended period of time is pretty insane to me.
Well, I don't think it'll be Jeff Bezos. It would be awesome if it were Jeff Bezos, because he has his own space tourism company. So like that would be really cool if he was like, I'm going to take a ride on yours first, Elon, and then see how it's done.
I mean, that's true. He's competing. So he probably won't any more than they would, I don't know, start selling Apple stuff that they don't want to sell. They don't sell Apple TVs anymore, I don't think. Mm. Wasn't that the deal? Something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
He's obviously a very competitive guy, but it's got to be people. We just know this much. It's got to be people with money. It's got to be people who are in the kind of health that is not an automatic write down that, oh, well, he's got diabetes, so get him out of here. It's got to be somebody who they think can perhaps go through the rigorous training, and it is rigorous. And those are the only two hints we have, money and fitness. And so I don't know who those people are. So we got to watch what Silicon Valley CEOs are all running on treadmills at, you know, health and fitness store, or places or whatever.
That's smart. Well, after the break, Ashley Escada from CNET is here to tell us about her experience in an IMAX VR pod. But first, let's take a minute to thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, the sponsor of this episode. Getting a mortgage is the least exciting part of the home buying experience. It's confusing. It's time consuming. No one wants to sit in a room full of strangers sweating while trying to prove how much money you have or don't have. That is something I like to do personally in the privacy of my own home. And I can with Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans offers you or me a transparent online process that gives you or me the confidence to make an informed decision. Don't waste time searching through stacks of paperwork. With Rocket Mortgage, you can securely share your financial info to get a mortgage approval in minutes. You can even adjust the rate and the length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the mortgage solution that's right for you. Whether you're looking to buy a home or refinance your existing mortgage, you can lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket mortgage. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/TNT. That's quickenloans.com/TNT. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. One of the biggest barriers to entry for virtual reality is the cost of getting your own in-home setup. But what if mainstream VR didn't happen inside our home? Here to talk about what she learned about virtual reality in a more social setting is Ashley Escada, senior editor at CNET. Welcome back to the show, Ashley.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So most people that I've talked to, myself included, have enjoyed their VR experiences very much, but we are unlikely to run out and get a Rift or a Vive anytime soon, even maybe not even a PlayStation VR, partially because of the cost, also because we don't have a whole room to dedicate to it. Tell us a little bit about what IMAX wants to do to get more people experiencing virtual reality.
Sure. This is, I thought, really interesting on IMAX's part. So they are opening 6 IMAX VR centers around the world this year. And what they want to do is they feel that VR is actually a very social experience, which is kind of funny when you think about VR. The first thing you think of is, wow, you're literally all by yourself in this little box. But IMAX feels that it's the opposite of that, that it is a very social experience. You can go to these centers with your friends. You can you rent out kind of a pod, and it's, you know, $7 to $10 per experience. There's between 10 and 15 pods at every one of the centers. And yeah, it's really cool. There's staffers inside each one. You can see kind of, we did this piece on it last week. There's me unboxing. It was really hard. I was super winded after that was over. I felt so out of shape because you actually have to weave and duck and jump around. And it was really tough, but they have all kinds of different experiences, and they also kind of up the ante a little bit as opposed to just being a headset. A lot of these have special equipment inside the pod. So I did a Rabbids VR ride that had a D chair. So you were able to sit in it, and then it would, you know, move around and rumble and everything while it was going. So it felt a little bit better. It was more immersive. And so, yeah, that's what they want to do. They want to charge $7 to $10 per experience. And then, again, between 10 and 15 pods per location. And they just opened this one in Beverly Hills. And they're going to open another one in Los Angeles this year, 2 in New York City, 1 in the UK, and 1 in China.
So is the, you did the math and you said like 100 visits would mean you could buy your own Rift for yourself. Is the idea that this would be like an amusement park that people will continue to go to? Or is there some sort of deal that IMAX has where they're trying to just spread interest in virtual reality?
So I think that it's a little, maybe a little bit of both. So I think IMAX is obviously very interested in virtual reality as a medium. Filmmakers are really getting into this. We're seeing virtual reality being featured at Sundance and Cannes. You know, they have these sort of separate areas now where you can see where they have these interactive films and things like that. But on top of that, it's a really good play for IMAX because most of these locations are going to actually be located inside IMAX theaters. So let's say in my article, I talked about this. Let's say you get out of John Wick 2, Chapter 2, and you're like super pumped about just kicking everybody and killing people and like whatever. And you see that the IMAX has this VR experience for John Wick, and you're like, I got to go check that out. And it's sort of this like added value experience that you'll be able to have where all of these experiences sort of rotate. So over time, you might see, I know that one of the pods that we saw was a Star Wars pod. And then there's, you know, other pods that have to do with video games that don't have movies attached to them. But overall, it's sort of this not quite theme park, but also not quite, it's not quite a standalone experience. Like I would argue that something more like The Void, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but that's this sort of very large warehouse where they have, you know, these kind of backpacks that have your VR headset hardware inside them. And you can go through these kind of blank slate simulations. It's almost like a cross between VR and laser tag where you're like completing some sort of demo. Ghostbusters worked with them to do something in New York last year for the release of the Paul Feig movie. And so I think that it's a little bit of both. It's definitely a little bit of both. But I would say it's at its core, it is an added value to any moviegoer.
Now, this is interesting. The Void's actually just like 30 minutes from me. I haven't been yet.
Oh, cool.
But it's here in Utah, just outside of Salt Lake. And those guys are awesome. They're doing really cool stuff out there. And apparently, from everyone I've talked to, it really is the real deal. It's like super awesome and delivers.
Must be amazing.
Yeah, it must be incredible. And I'm totally going to do it. However, there does seem to be kind of a generalized bullishness in the industry, the VR space or whatever we want to call it, where many don't seem convinced that this is a solitary experience, that this isn't necessarily going to be best served as something for somebody sitting in front of a computer for hours playing a game or being through a simulation or whatever, that in fact the best application is a more public
bite-sized experiences where it's like very sort of, oh hey, like on a whim I'm just gonna go spend $10 and be John Wick.
Yeah, and you don't have to own it. You don't have to maintain it. I still have major issues with any public place and thousands of heads having the same headset on it and not having
eye disease. That's very serious.
Yeah, it can get real weird real quick. Like E3 is known for this when they do those demos. GDC is known for it. Like, just be careful out there, folks. Lots of Purell.
Sure.
But it, does it seem to you like that? Is that really a place where this market is going to head in a major way? And do you think that is this just a stopgap until the headsets get lighter, smaller, and easier and more affordable for everyone just to have one on them all the time?
I think you make a really valid point in that most people, when they try VR, I have PlayStation VR, and I was playing Psychonauts in the Rhombus of Ruin yesterday with my brother. He came over before the Oscars. We played for a little while, for about 45 minutes, and then both of us were kind of like, I feel fatigued. Like, I feel tired. And it does kind of take your energy away from you in a way that is not so much so with, playing a regular PC shooter or playing a console game. So I do think that there is value in those sort of shorter experiences. Also, it makes it easier for filmmakers and studios and game developers to kind of make these really tight, compact, good experiences. It's kind of the British television approach to things, where if it's really small and really tightly woven, then it doesn't have to be, it can be really excellent. And I think that's the thing that needs to happen in order to send people to VR to buy for their own homes. So I do think that, it is a stopgap in a way, because of all of those factors that we've talked about. The space, the idea of somebody buying a dedicated headset that needs to be connected to a desktop computer at your house, or, pretty hefty laptop in a backpack. I think those are definitely early adopter kind of methods. And we are going to get to a point where even HTC now is talking about, oh, we have this, peripheral that's going to let you go wireless, and we have all these things going on. So I think at the end of the day, it is a stopgap, but it's also, for me, I think this is actually the way most people will enjoy VR, in a really high quality way. So it's a little bit like making a home theater system. So very few people, but more today than say 10 years ago, have super high-end screens, like an OLED 4K HDR screen. There's not a lot of people who are willing to invest the money in that. They also, don't have these really high-end Dolby Atmos surround sound systems and stuff like that for their homes, because they can go to the movies for $15 and get that at a movie theater. And I think that is kind of the way, my guess is that will be kind of the way VR ends up being, where it's like, I have this cool, Google Cardboard or, Daydream VR, but also I love these super cool high-end experiences, and I know I can go to, pop down to IMAX and go play a VR game or check something out that I really want to see. But again, it's like 800 times before it would amortize out. So it feels like this is definitely a thing like any casual VR user could get behind.
Oh yeah, I totally agree. The only other thing I would tack onto that is these things tend to flop the other direction eventually. Like, we go look at computers. It was rare when I was a kid to find somebody else with a personal home computer, because they were paying $5,000-$6,000 for that thing. It was outrageously expensive. And
now
it was like this huge luxury. And now it's weird if you don't have one. Like, cell phones are the same way. Everything kind of hits this crescendo. I used to go to arcades to get my high-end video game fix, and I would play the crappy stuff on an Atari or an NES. Now it's right. The other way around.
Yeah.
We probably will get to that place where it's the other way around, but we're just not there yet, I guess.
Yeah. Do you think, just out of curiosity, do you think, because I have this conversation with my friends all the time, do you think that AR is going to end up being the thing that is the tipping point, that everybody will experience AR on a regular basis? That'll be sort of the consumer mass adoption technology, and then VR will sort of be more of the specialized thing?
I think no matter what, in the long run, it'll be some sort of mix of those two things. I don't think it'll ever be only one or only the other. I think it'll end up being devices that on the fly can turn virtual worlds into partially augmented reality worlds where you're looking at the real world and playing Pokemon Go with a pair of glasses and a bus stop or something, or whatever the equivalent of that will be at the time. But when that happens, it will be because whatever is the lightest thing that didn't cost you an arm and a leg to buy and has the fidelity you want. We're kind of there with cell phones right now. We got to get to that place with VR and AR before anyone has any kind of mass adoption kind of plan. And it's going to be real Wild West and weird until we get there. That I'm sure of.
Yeah. I mean, talking to game developers has been really fun because Wild West is the exact phrase I've heard many of them use to describe virtual reality compared to when they started developing games in 3D for PlayStation. And so this is, and Nintendo 64. So this was, they're like, you know, when we started, we didn't know if people would want control of the cameras in games. Like that wasn't a thing before a Crash Bandicoot. And so they gave people that option. And now it's one of those things where when I can't control the camera in a game, I freak out. Like, I'm like, give me control. but it's such a norm now. But in VR, that actually can cause motion sickness when you have too much control of your motion for the camera on a thumbstick. So you end up sort of having this inherent problem where Resident Evil 7 made a lot of people sick at E3 last year. And it was because they had a free swinging, really kind of high sensitivity, free motion camera. And so if I was looking down at something here with a VR headset, I would be looking at a note. And then just out of sheer habit, I would move the thumbstick to turn the camera because you don't think about having a headset on. And as soon as you turn that camera, but your head doesn't move along with what you're seeing inside the headset, your headset goes this way and your head stays over here. That's when you feel sick. And so this is now another new Wild West for developers to sort of figure out, like, how can we make these things? I think you're absolutely right. It's portability, price, and content. Like those three things all have to be really, really, really good. And I think, you know, portability and price and content are sort of like, they're out here right now and we need them all to kind of be here-ish.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Well, does the AR aspect of it make it a little less isolating? Like you talked about how a person could go with you. You could go to the IMAX pod and just sit and watch you doing in the pod playing the game. But with AR, you could see each other and work together, right?
Yeah. And I think, so like I said, this is a conversation we have, like my friends and I have a lot and colleagues and I have had before, where it feels like AR will be that technology that is, that will tie in really well to a virtual assistant. So virtual assistants right now, we have these little devices and we say, you know, hey, Alexa, like, sorry for anybody who has an Alexa. give me the weather, you know, whatever you want to say to it. And it tells you all these things. Well, at some point, I should hope we'll have these virtual assistants give us this information in augmented reality. So it kind of all ties in together. It's very Jarvis-esque, you know, wonderful future that I like to think of. But I think that is the technology that people will use more on a daily basis in terms of kind of like mass adoption. So, but when you start looking at VR, it feels like that's a thing that is very much like going to the movies, which is, you know, not a thing that I use every single day. I don't go to a movie theater every single day of my life. There are some people who do, and that's great for them. Or they build a home theater in their home, also great for them. But I choose to have that experience and go out with friends or with my husband to a movie. And I have a feeling that VR will become more adopted by people, but also those really high-end experiences, a lot of people who are not super nerds like us are going to be like, well, I'll just, you know, like catch this cool VR thing that happens to be at the movie theater.
Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm.
Well, Ashley, thank you so much for joining us. Ashley Skeda's work can be seen on CNET. There's a great video that she did at the IMAX. She does lots of great videos. She's a senior video editor, and she is Ashley Skeda on Twitter. Thank you so much for joining us.
As always, a pleasure. Thanks for having me. Bye, guys.
Bye. So last week we discussed Waze Carpool. That's a service from Google that pays drivers 54 cents a mile to take strangers to their destination that they're already going to. Now, 54 cents a mile is a federal deduction if you use your car for work. And I wondered if you could still take that deduction if you drove an electric car, and Carol wrote in to say, yes, you can. And I do take the business mile deduction if you have an electric car. That's an interesting idea. You could make some money, maybe. Probably not at 40 cents. 54 cents a mile, but did you guys, I'm sure on some show you covered the Waze Carpool story, Scott.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's just another example of, I don't know what else, it almost goes with our conversation about Twitch a little bit, but everything, as it turns out in our modern times, seems like it might be monetizable. And even though 50 cents a mile is kind of a microtransaction, there'll be somebody somewhere who will min-max that out and end up making an extraordinary amount of money and blow everybody's mind. And I love that stuff. I love watching how people figure that stuff out. It's very gamifying to watch somebody find something like that and figure out a way to make it work for them. So as small as it is, I think we might be surprised at, you know, somebody figuring out a way to make bank.
Well, after the break, more bad karma for GoPro's drone. But first, let's take a minute to thank Epson, the sponsor of this episode. Epson's revolutionary cartridge-free EcoTank line of printers for home and office introduce a new age in printing. The EcoTank ET4550 wireless all-in-one printer doesn't use ink cartridges. Instead, it features an amazing, innovative, refillable ink tank, earning it the title of CES 2016 Innovation Awards honoree. So no more out-of-ink frustration. You've been there. This Epson includes up to 2 years of ink. That's equal to 11,000 black pages or 8,500 color pages. You can also save up to 80% on ink with low-cost replacement bottles. It's powered by precision core printing technology. It has auto two-sided printing and a 30-page auto document feeder. Easy wireless printing from tablets and smartphones. All EcoTank printers deliver an unbeatable combination of convenience and value. With Epson's EcoTank line of printers, you'll have the freedom to print without running out of ink. The Epson EcoTank system was named the 2016 Small Biz Windows Printer of the Year. So visit Epson.com/EcoTank today to transform the way your home, office, or workgroup prints. For the best combination of ease and value, turn to the Epson EcoTank printers. That's EPSON.com/EcoTank. And we thank Epson for their support. The new GoPro drones are experiencing some very bad karma. First, they were recalled after falling from the sky due to a faulty battery latch. And now, one woman in New York City says a drone crashed through her apartment window. According to the New York Post, the quadcopter broke the 27th floor window of a Manhattan building and landed just feet away from the 66-year-old woman who lives in the apartment. The drone's owner is still unknown. That must have been terrifying.
It must have been, but it could have been any drone. Like Like, you know what I'm waiting for? This is right along lines with my prediction about drones. I love them. They're way cool. They're awesome in every way. But we're just waiting for that first gnarly experience with a drone that just is real bad. I don't know what it is yet, but some kid's going to fly one into a fuselage engine, or we're going to find one, you know, some poor mailman impaled on one in the middle of the street or something weird. And it's going to be dire for whoever made the drone. It's not going to be as much about the person who was flying it or how they broke the rules or how they were being bad at this. But there are two things on people's minds. I can't believe it was a karma. They should have made that thing safer. And then we're going to get regulated to high heaven and back on drones from here on forward. So I feel like that time should have come. And I know there's been some weird drone things in the past, but I'm a little shocked we haven't had some really bad drone thing happen in a neighborhood or in a otherwise quiet place. And I feel like I'm just on pins and needles waiting for that thing to hit the news. And it's going to be gnarly when that happens.
Yeah. I don't really get the physics of this. I mean, I am surprised it was able to break the window. at all. Burke has something to say. We can take the Burke cam for a second. I don't know if you can, but we don't have the Burke cam. Sorry. He says that it was Padre flying, which I don't think. He's in San Francisco, so that would be really hard, I think, to fly a drone. There we go. There's the Burke cam. Thank you.
It was Padre. Nice.
I think it would be really difficult to fly a drone from San Francisco to New York City.
Yeah. They don't have that kind of battery life, unfortunately. We're not quite there yet. But I mean, I've seen those things move pretty quickly. But you're right. That's that high up in a Manhattan building, they have certain code for those windows. Mm-hmm. I don't think they just come crumbling in with any old force. I think it had to have been coming pretty fast.
Yeah. So, they don't know who the drone owner was yet. I have one drone that I registered faithfully. I did what I was supposed to do. So what happens? This guy either registered it or he didn't. If he didn't, he gets away scot-free, except for he doesn't get his drone back. If he did register it, then he gets, he'll get charged with criminal mischief. It's illegal to, recreational drone flying is illegal in most places in New York City except parks. So it kind of makes you think, don't register your drone. I mean, I'm not saying that, but that makes me think that. Some people might think that.
That's the point. Every time one of these incidents happens, it's a reason for people to put their heads together and say, what else do we need to do to regulate drones? And I'm not anti-regulation, I'm not pro-regulation. I'm just sort of, we need to do whatever the prudent smart thing is. And maybe the prudent and smart thing is to treat them more like potential weapons. I know they're not weapons, but if we go so far my buddy up the street wants to go shooting at the rifle range, he needs to be registered. He has to be able to show that the guns he's taken, he owns, and the guns he's using there, he's allowed to, and all of that sort of thing. Maybe drones will start falling into a category where we have to be that kind of responsible. We have to do it with our cars. We do it with our planes. We do it with any personal property that can potentially harm somebody in a public way. I think we're just heading to a place where there's going to be more of that. Hopefully it's not too overreachy.
Yeah. So you're saying that all drones should be required, and they should go after people who haven't registered their drones.
I think they should go after them with drones is what I'm saying.
Okay, good. I like that. Could have come from another building. Yeah, Burke's on the case. He's doing studying. Someone in the chat room said, did he use gloves? Dale Poco from the chat room said, did he use gloves? He or she? I'm sorry for saying it was a he. We don't know. And I was going to make a joke about women being bad drivers of drones, but I'm not going to. But yeah, I guess they could look at fingerprints too.
Yeah, there's traditional forensics you could do with this thing and try to track down who the owner was. But I guess it depends on the amount of damage. Did it just break the window and land on the floor and not hurt anybody? Is the potential of that so scary that they want to go that far? I don't know. I'm saying, this may not be the one, but we're waiting for a landmark case with drones. Don't know when it's going to happen. Don't know where it's going to be. Probably in this country and probably in a city and probably under circumstances where, unfortunately, somebody's going to get hurt. And I don't look forward to that. So, I mean, hopefully we're being smart about this. I know owners of drones who are way smart about how they use their drones. They're super smart about it. And drones are getting better at being smart themselves. I don't know if the CARM is supposed to be better at collision detection, which is something we haven't talked about here. Mm. I don't know enough about the CARM to say so, but a modern drone, for the most part, has some expectation for how it uses global positioning and how it uses collision detection. And it's very easy to avoid in newer models of what Phantom's making and others. So if the Karma's not doing a good job at that, maybe this just comes back down to them, to GoPro, tweaking this thing again or their next model of this thing so that it's better at detecting that there is a big flat piece of glass in front of me and I can't hit it.
Mm. Brian, do you know if it's supposed to be better?
Yeah, it should be better than that. But I know as far as DJI, I took the Phantom 4, which does have the collision detection and stuff, and I went to an area that didn't have Wi-Fi, and I couldn't even use it until I connected it to the internet and registered it. So I'm kind of skeptical. How do they not know whose drone this was that it flew through? Maybe it just destroyed itself, so they can't even turn it back on. But kind of weird, because most of the newer drones, it's you can't even fly them until you register it and put all your information in online. And then there's elevation restrictions, can't fly higher than 400 feet, can't be more than a mile away from the controller. So drones are definitely getting smaller and are smarter and more restricted as far as what you can and can't do with them.
See, that makes it even a deeper conspiracy, because what if this thing wasn't even flying? What if someone catapulted it from like another building off like some homemade trebuchet they made in their backyard.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I'm sure a trebuchet was involved. Absolutely.
It was the French. Keep your eye on the ball, people. It's a false flag. Someone trebucheted over Manhattan. You heard it here first.
Yes, exactly. Well, Scott, it has been a pleasure, as always. Twitch.com/frogpants, frogpants.com. Where else?
You can find me on Twitter, at Scott Johnson. Always something to say over there. Always open to communication with people directly there. And I would point your – well, the problem is we're out of tickets now, so pointing people there isn't going to do them a whole lot of good, except to say we plan on live streaming this year's 10th anniversary Nerdtacular event. We'll have a whole bunch of fellow producers, podcasters, celebrities of various types there in Snowbird, Utah again this year. We'll be at that event in June, late June. If you want details on how to catch that and any breaking news about how to be a part of that community event, you can find details at nerdtacular.com, but all of it leads back to Frog Pants. So go check it out. And thank you for having me on. I love being on with you.
Oh, I love having you on. And yes, it's true. All of it leads back to frogpants.com. All Not just what you're talking about, but all of it. It's the answer to everything, essentially. Thank you so much. We'll see you soon, Scott.
You bet.
Take care. Jason Bye-bye. Will be back tomorrow, and TNT records live every Monday through Friday. That's Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, midnight UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show just by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv or leave us a video. Send a video to tnt@twit.tv. We love to see videos. Or you can leave a voicemail. Make it short because we can't play it unless it's very short, like around 30 seconds or 20 seconds. If you have to leave a one and then leave another one, that's fine. We will listen to as many as you want to send. That's 260-TNT-SHOW. You can also find us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV, and you can subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNT. And if you want to tweet at me, I'm at Megan Maroney. Thank you to our technical director and drone expert, Brian. Thank you to, I love the Brian cam. It's so good. Thank you to Burke for being Burke and for his hands, thumbs up, and all that Burke does. And thank you to Kevin for editing the show. We need a Kevin cam. Thank you to you. We need a you cam. That's what we need. We want to see everyone, and we will see you tomorrow.